And at Helsberg, well, like a couple of years ago, I spent like, I had 10 hours a week with you in various design meetings, and it's been a while, so it's great to catch up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, Anders.
Hi there.
So, Anders, what have you been working on lately?
Well, C-sharp.
C-sharp?
Well, C-sharp 4.0, of
Yeah.
course, and then 5.0 as well. We're always sort of thinking a few ahead.
Okay, good. So that then now then we can kind of maybe extract some secrets here about C# 5.0, but let's start with C# 4.0. So one of the big things in C# 4.0 is dynamic, right? So can you explain a little bit about what the concepts behind this implementation of dynamics are?
Yeah. Well, so to sort of set the stage, C-sharp is a statically typed programming language, which means that the compiler has metadata that for every type it knows what are the members of the type, like the methods and the properties and so forth. And when you have a value of a particular type, like a reference to an object, and you say blah dot, then the compiler knows what can go after the dot because it has metadata that represents it. Sometimes what you have is maybe not the most derived type, so you can cast, and then the compiler can check that the cast is correct, and then so forth. And this works fine as long as you have this metadata, but there are obviously a lot of scenarios where you do not have the
Where you have
metadata.
it at compile
Or
time.
at compile time, yeah, or at all. Well, I mean, you, well, in some cases you don't have any at all, really.
Yeah.
I mean, like, take an XML document without an XSD schema, there's no metadata, period. There is what there is. And in a sense, there's no way at compile time you can know whether when you dot off an XML element, whether it's going to be valid. And so you can now say you can't do it, or you say you can do it, and then check later, in a sense. And XML documents is just one example. We have a lot of dynamic programming languages that don't have this kind of metadata as well. There are a bunch of web services, RESTful APIs. REST is, in a sense, all about not having the metadata that all of WSDL and whatever, was trying to impose on us. So more and more there are cases where you're talking to something in a dynamic fashion. Well, another example is like the JavaScript DOM or the HTML DOM from Silverlight or whatever. So more and more we have scenarios where you're going to talk to something for which there is no metadata and for which we cannot statically check what you're doing is correct or not. Now, unfortunately, it has been very hard to do this in statically typed languages because, the language doesn't as such support it, and so now you have to go through some sort of API that allows you to escape the static type checking, right?
Yeah.
And you have to say, my object dot get member of foo in quotes dot invoke of object array of arguments or whatever.
Yes, yeah.
And for each domain, it's different the way you do that. And it is sort of spotty what coverage you have and whatever. And so doing dynamic things from the static programming language C# has been painful. And what we're doing with our support in 4.0 is making it less painful, recognizing the fact that this is really a mainstream scenario, and in a sense putting a unifying mechanism in place in the language that allows you to just dot off something that is dynamic and then have that be checked later at runtime and dispatched, later at runtime.
So in some sense, it seems like a common theme in C# is to get rid of these kind of little strings, right? Because in some sense, that was behind link too, where you wrote queries in strings, and now, that was kind of, now covered with a nice, sweet layer
Yeah,
of link,
in link
and now
though,
here.
in link it was about taking the but in a sense, in link it was about taking the queries out of strings, at least when
Yes.
you're talking to databases,
Yes.
such that you could get compile time type checking
Yes.
on them. This is about removing the syntactic pain, but
Yes.
not the compile time type checking.
Yes.
I mean, just
Yeah.
recognizing that these scenarios don't have any metadata to check against anyway. So
Yep.
But in a sense, you could say we're tearing down the force coupling between lack of metadata and pain in accessing, right? And we're saying,
Yes.
hey, if even in cases where you don't have metadata, it it could still look like nice normal code, like it would in a scripting language, right? There's really nothing to say that just because you don't have metadata, it has to be incomprehensible reflection like gobbledygook,
yes.
You know.
Yeah. But there's also like another scenario that's kind of maybe complementary, where you do have like you, as a programmer, you have static knowledge of the shape of things, but the values are different. So, for example, I know that, you know, what I get back from this web service has like a name and an age or something.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I, you know, would it also be possible to have something where you can now impose like a static type?
This is sort of like duck typing.
Duck
using
typing,
using,
yes.
Like interfaces.
Yes,
or,
where I can kind of
whatever.
Slam an interface on a value.
I think in a sense, I'm not sure that really is a language thing as much as it is a runtime thing.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you could build that service in the CLR. Indeed, I think you can use some of our remoting proxy support to build it, actually, today. I just don't think a lot of people do. And I'm not sure how important a scenario is, but certainly it can be done. And in a sense, it can, of course, also be done with our dynamic support, but then you don't get the... I mean, in a sense, what you're advocating is do a one-time check that this dynamic entity has the following
yes.
members, and then from there on out, you can sort of do the lookup once and then perhaps get speed
yes.
or dispatch.
Yes. Yeah.
We don't allow you to bundle that up, but we do actually give you the cache dispatch and whatever through the dynamic language runtime and so forth. So it's... They're very similar.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me that there's enough differentiation there that we want to do both. But
And so you mentioned like one example was to kind of access like an XML document.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a way for programmers to kind of specialize how the lookup is done?
Right.
For example, because there might be attributes and
sure.
elements and so
sure.
on. So.
Sure. Yeah. So. So I should say that the way we do the dynamic dispatch and the dynamic lookup is we use the dynamic language runtime,
okay.
which is being built by Jim Hugenin's team and is part of .NET 4.0. The dynamic language runtime sort of has multiple levels of binding resolution that you can hook into, if you will, or that it will do for you. If what you're talking to is a COM object, for example, mm-hmm. then it knows to ask for the iDispatch and do the appropriate thing. If what you're talking to is a CLR object, then it knows to, of course, use reflection and query the object's metadata. But for other kinds of objects, these other kinds of objects can themselves do the resolution. So you can implement an interface called iDynamicObject, or actually you can inherit from a class called DynamicObject, which implements mm-hmm. that interface. And then you can yourself do the resolution. So you can yourself say, call this method called invokeMember whenever a member is invoked on me, and let me then do whatever is appropriate. And so you could do little lightweight proxies around XML elements, and then capture property lookup and then simply turn that into an XML element
yes.
lookup, and there you have it. Now, of course, you would have to find some sort of scheme to distinguish between elements and attributes. It's the sort of unfortunate accident of history in XML that there are two kinds of members that no one really knows whether one is better than the other. But there it is. But one could imagine schemes where you sort of prefix with ATTR on the bar or what have you, it's certainly possible to build these things very simply. I mean, I the one we're talking about here is like it's five lines of code, in C#.
Okay, so that's so. And are there any other features, kind of big features in C# 4.0 except dynamic?
Well, so there's. Well, dynamic is probably the biggest feature, but there are a bunch of other features, named and optional parameters, which is something that has long been requested, and sort of lumped together with dynamic. If you take dynamic, named and optional parameters, and also our support for no PS,
mm-hmm.
or no primary interop assemblies, that whole package together gives us much, much better interoperability with COM and Olay automation and the office automation model, you know, where there have been some very unfortunate patterns there with methods taking 30-some parameters where you have to say type.missing 30 times. And yes, and we're doing our mea culpa here and and fixing that once and for all. I should also mention we have co and contravariance now, which actually has been in the CLR ever since generics were introduced, but has really not been surfaced in any of our mainline programming languages, and we're now surfacing it in C-sharp and EB.
And so are any of the BCL types now also exposed, like IEnumerable, comes to mind, of course.
Exactly. So the kind of covariance we implement is, what's it called? Type safe use site declaration site. Covariance for interfaces and delegate types. If you want to be real precise about what it is. So covariance is supported only with interfaces and delegate types, and we will in .NET 4.0 decorate those interfaces that are and contravariant in the BCL. It turns out that it's not that many. It's not hundreds. It's more in the tens. And you know, I think the biggest one there is IEnumerable, probably. But having IEnumerable be covariant is very big for any kind of link scenario, any kind of query scenario. Just because it's sort of
can you explain why that is? I mean, Eric, of course, automatically understands, but let's some of the people in the audience.
So the way to think of co and contravariance. Well, the way to think of covariance is if you have arrays. I mean, think of arrays, first of all, because arrays today are covariant in .NET. So the way I think of it, at least, is we have, take type string, which derives from type object.
Okay.
Covariance then implies that a string array is covariant with an object array, such that wherever an object array is expected, you could pass a string array instance instead. Now it turns out interestingly that this isn't type safe. A lot of people maybe don't even realize that there's a hole there. In fact, there are languages I know of that shall not mention any names, but languages in the industry that have shipped and gone through many years of use without anyone actually realizing that there was a hole in their type system because they had covariance where it wasn't safe. The unsafety is, well, maybe I should use the whiteboard.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's
look at whiteboard's good.
Where it is. So let's say we declare some variable of type object array OA equals, and then let's say we set it equal to a new string array. With 10 elements in it. And now, of course, we can do happy things like say OA sub 0 equals hello. And this is all good and fine because we're putting a string into our string array instance.
Okay.
But since it is statically typed here as an object array, we could also say OA sub 1 equals, I don't know,
5.
Get a boxed int or new up some other object. And the compiler doesn't see anything wrong here. You know, hey, this was permitted because of covariance, and now we have an object array, and surely an int is an object, so we can put that into the object array. Except if I were to actually, well, let me make it a little more clear here. Let's first say string array SA here equals new string array of 10. And then because of covariance, we can say object array equals string array. And now down here, well, this all looks like it's hunky-dory, right? But now what if I pick out, you know, say string S equals string array sub 1 now? now you can sort of see that, well, there's something fishy here. Something is going to go wrong here, because in there I now have a boxed int and I'm trying to store it in a string variable. And now if I say s.toUpper or whatever, it's going to try to call that method on an int, and the world's going to blow up. Yeah. So where is the problem? Is the question then. And then, well, the problem is actually here. You know, the fact that we allow this. Because covariant arrays are not safely covariant. And now you can wonder, well, why are they not safely covariant? Well, it's because it is actually perfectly safe in a covariant situation to read elements out. So you can store a string array as an object array. And at that point, it is perfectly safe to take elements out and treat them as objects, because we know that we're going to just be taking strings out. And treating them as objects is less derived, and that's not a problem.
Okay.
But it is not safe to store objects into the object array without a check. And so we actually now in the runtime, because of this, have to, on every store into an array, generate a dynamic type check. And so that is the cost of our array implementation, of our covariant array implementation. Now, it is actually possible to have a different view of this, though. And let's see, now maybe we should go to another whiteboard here. Another pen that actually works.
Those are secret C-sharp 5.0 constructs.
Wow, the new financial keyword.
Let's see if I can think of an example here. Let's take now, we have our interface called IEnumerable. And in here we have, well, it has one member, really, one member that we care about right now. It has an IEnumerator. Of t, get enumerator. And then actually, if we look at the interface, IEnumerator of t, it has two members, bool, move next, and t current, which is a read-only property. When something implements IEnumerable, the thing that's interesting about IEnumerable is that it allows you to take elements out of this collection, to read the elements.
Yes.
But there's nothing anywhere in this interface that allows you to put stuff into it.
Okay.
And because things only come out, but nothing ever goes in, it is actually a safely covariant interface. You can take an IEnumerable of string and treat it as an IEnumerable of object.
Because
safely.
Because when you read something, it's always kind of, you know, a subtype of the thing you read.
There's no method anywhere in these two interfaces that allows me to put in new T's.
Understood.
So sort of intuitively, this is safe. Now, the way that we take this intuition and actually encode it in the type system is that we allow you to now put a modifier on a type parameter. So you can declare IEnumerable of out t. Hmm. And when you put, and conversely, there's an in modifier that you could put on and have a contravariant interface. I'll talk about an example of that. But let's just look at this guy first. When you put this modifier on the interface, you are indicating to the compiler that I want this interface to behave covariantly in this type parameter precision.
Okay.
And conversely, I want you to check now that I never use this T in anything but an output precision. And an output precision is a function result or a property result and so forth.
Okay.
It can never come in, so it can never be a parameter. No parameter can use T, even as a constructed type. And you see here, for example, that the only way this becomes possible is also if we add an out down here, because otherwise I'm trying to use this T here in a precision that didn't say out. But if we say out on both of them, now we've said these two interfaces are covariant. And the compiler will complain if I now try to declare, like down here, void foo or void store or add, yes, better. Void add of tx. Say all of a sudden in my enumerator, I can add new elements. The compiler is going to go,
no, you can't
do this because t is constrained to output positions only.
Excellent.
Because the interface is covariant. Now, so that's what covariance means. And effectively, because of that, it is now possible for me to say IEnumerable of object x equals, and then set it equal to something that implements IEnumerable of string, like, say, string list, or my list of strings, or my string array, or what have you.
Okay.
And have this work. And this previously did not work, and it was always a bother.
Yes. So for example, one example where this goes all the time is when you're, say, querying, you know, like students and professors, and I want to kind of union them or kind of, you know, pass them to the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And there's, you know, there's a common supertype, which is IEnumerable of person, but, you know, because it wasn't covariant, you couldn't do that.
Right. Excellent.
Okay, so quickly then, there's actually the converse of covariance, which is contravariance. Let me erase this now, and then let me give you an example of another interface we have, which is I compare of t. It has one method called compare. That takes two t's, t and ty, and returns an int, you know, minus or less than zero if this is smaller, zero if they're equal, greater than zero if x is larger than y. This interface, if you think about it intuitively again, can sort of function not covariantly but contravariantly. Let's say I have something that can compare objects, an object comparer. And now I have a method that expects a string comparer, something that can compare strings. Well, hey, I could pass it my object comparer, right? Because, hey, it's going to give me strings. Fine, they're objects, so that would be safe, right? However, we would not permit that today. If you have a method that expects a comparer of string, you cannot pass it a comparer of object today. However, with contravariance, that becomes possible. And contravariance is the in modifier on a type argument. And it basically tells the compiler, I want this interface to be contravariant. And in return, you must now guarantee that this T only ever occurs in input positions, which means as method parameters or in property setters. So you could have a write-only property of type T, but you couldn't have something that returns a T. Because that would not be contravariant. Now, all of this sort of makes your head hurt a bit, because it's just not a very simple thing to think about. But
sure.
But I think the good news about it is you don't have to understand all of this. The thing that will magically sort of occur in .NET 4.0 is that all of these cases where I couldn't take an IEnumerable and pass it to this one over there, even though I can't understand why that wouldn't be safe, well, now you can.
Excellent. And safely.
And safely so.
Yeah. So what in some sense happening is like certain type restrictions are eliminated. So you can pass more now that you couldn't do before, where there would be a type error, and that's now kind of, you know, enabled by this.
Excellent. So, I mean, this is great because I think concepts are important.
Yep.
Right? And these are very important concepts. Thank you, Anders.
Oh, sure.
Yep. Anders on the whiteboard. I love it.
Yep.
All right, what's going on?
All right, so C# 4.0, so One of the things, like, you know, I think it's like in maybe everybody's mind is like, you know, what about, like, you know, extension? We now have extension methods. Will we ever have, you know, extension properties and right. extension, you know, events? And
well, we spent a lot of time thinking about that. And so far we have decided no. We're going to stick with just extension methods to listeners who may not, you know what is an extension method or an extension member or whatever. It's the ability to extend existing types with new members, or at least have the illusion of doing so by putting static methods in a class and then using the this modifier on the first argument, and having those methods then appear to be members of anything yep. that is of that type.
I find them very addictive.
They are very addictive, yes. And they're actually, interestingly, they are more expressive for certain things. For example, let's say you want to define a set of methods over, you know, an innumerable of t or whatever. Well, there's no way you could do that other than with extension
yes,
members.
Yes.
It's not like you could derive a new interface from innumerable of t and add the members there, because that doesn't make all these...
Yep.
other interfaces implemented or other implementations support them, and so interestingly it's more expressive and it adds a whole new dimension of extensibility to the language. So yeah, I'm very happy with the extension methods, and people do ask, in particular they ask about extension properties.
Yeah.
Now from that it sort of follows that really, well, if you could have properties, shouldn't you also then be able to have events, which sure. And how about extension operators and extension, well, extension any kind of member, really,
yep.
if you think about it. Some people even want extension fields. That gets a lot harder.
Yes,
now you have to have some global dictionary or whatever.
Yep.
But we spent a lot of time thinking about ways to do extension properties. The problem is that there is no convenient existing construct that we could just sort of overload, if you will. And for methods, we just overload regular methods, in a sense. Just you add a this modifier, and then now you have the illusion of having another method with one fewer arguments, you know, that is an instance method. But with properties, we don't support properties that have parameters.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to have extension properties, we would have to first add indexed properties, and it's, well, where did that come from? No one bargained for that one. Well, maybe some OLE automation people
yes.
would have bargained for it, but you know,
and they are in VB.
And they are in VB, but they're not in the CLS, but they're never used in the frameworks, and honestly, they do add a lot of confusion because they sort of look like an object, but they're not really. You can't separate the act of indexing the object from the object, and anyway. So in other words, the doing extension properties would add a much larger syntactic
yes,
footprint
yeah.
to the language, and then likewise for events. And so far we felt that it is not worth the hassle. We did have some designs in place, you know, one where we actually added these index properties, another where we turned it all into patterns over methods. You know, a get method or a set method, and sort of whenever there was a get blah blah blah, then it would appear you had an extension blah 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 property, but people didn't quite like that, you know, and because that's not how regular properties work, and now it wouldn't be symmetric with regular
yeah.
properties, and we just don't know of a good way of doing it so far, and so far the ways we've come up with are not good enough. If anybody has any ideas, I'd be happy to hear them. You know, it's never too late. It's not that we don't want to do it. It's just we want to do it right, and we don't know the right way.
Yeah. So you told a little bit about, like, you know, the kind of various stages in the design that you go through, and I think we have seen this on Channel 9 before, but I want to kind of, you know, ask you again. Like, one of the things that I found, you know, being in the C# design team, extremely productive is the way the C# design meetings are run.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I see a lot of other teams are trying to imitate that, but I don't think any other team does it as good as the C# team.
Mm-hmm.
So can you kind of, you know, explain a little bit of, like, you know, how the C# kind of design process works, and
Sure.
He's channeling Willamuth.
I think the thing that probably is most important is the continuity of the process. The fact that we sort of practice continuous design, I would say, which means that we don't do our design in spurts at the beginning of a project, and then first we design, and then we go implement, and then 2 years later it's time for the next version, and then we do a bit of design again. Rather, we continually do the design process. In fact, we've had a series of design meetings that have now been ongoing for 10 years. Every Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 1 to 3. In the beginning it was a little longer, but since we had a little more ground to cover. and some of the members have been there all along. Scott Wiltemuth, who's next door, has been there along with me. Some people have moved on, new people have come in. But it's the same. It's the same core idea all the way through, that we do ongoing design, you know, and that you have a body of people that have a shared vision in their heads about what the philosophy of the product is. And what it gives you is, you know, whenever you have a good idea, you can arrive at the design meeting, and within 2 minutes you can be having a deep discussion about this feature because everybody has pretty much the same mental picture. What happens too often when you don't have ongoing design is that you first got to like gather people together. Well, they're not there. There's no meeting coming up, so you got to set up a meeting. Oh, well, he's out of town. We can't have it for another 2 weeks. Then you finally have the meeting. Then you got to spend the first 45 minutes of the meeting establishing a common context so you can even talk about your idea. Mm-hmm. And then by the time you finally get around to talking about your idea, you're out of time. And I think, in a sense, you know, design should be ongoing because that is how you ensure that the product has a continuous personality and a continuous feel to it in between the different versions, right? Because it's the same people with the same mindset, The other thing that we do in our design meetings is we take pretty meticulous notes from our from our meetings, and we keep them in, you know, or we used to keep them in one big doc file, and that got too big, so now we keep them in one per year or whatever, but you're now using the wonderful feature called desktop search. You just type in a few keywords and boom, there's that feature you discussed 4 years ago that you couldn't quite remember. What was it? And well, there it is, you know, and you, because with language design it's sort of it moves slowly, and then the same ideas come up in different guises, and you kind of recall, 3 years ago we did talk about that, and we never quite got there, but there was a good base of information that if you could only just recall it, you know, and so we practice that.
And another thing that I kind of really like is that, you know, in the design meetings, a lot of code, then like the whiteboard is always filled with code samples afterwards. So, you know, it's like, whereas I think often design is done without really writing code, where you cannot smell if, you know, everything is right. So,
it's all about code.
yes.
Well, better ways of writing code,
Cool. All right, well, you've done your pitch. You'll probably get invited to the C-Sharp 5.0 design team.
Eric was in there for a long time.
Absolutely. He helped you guys out with Link and various other kind of things.
Yeah, that's been great.
But so, continue. Right, go ahead.
I wanted to kind of go and ask about C-Sharp 5.0 because I'm really curious. You know?
Oh, no.
I can only in broad strokes talk about that.
Anything you can share, you know.
Broad strokes, direction.
Yes.
Let me guess, concurrency, parallelism maybe?
We've been doing a lot of interviews recently about concurrency, and people are confused.
Yes.
And it's like there's so many things and it's unclear, you know, what's winning, or, you know, what should people kind of do?
Yeah. Well, count me in. I'm with you. I'm confused too. No, I don't think there is a clear answer right now with concurrency. And honestly, there hasn't been a clear answer for concurrency for the entire history of computer science, right?
Yes.
It's been a hard problem. It continues to be a hard problem. Now, it's a more pressing problem, and I would say we're probably applying more resources to the problem now than we have in the preceding decades, and so maybe this will yield some better results. I think, we like just the other day we were talking about, you know, like this, everywhere you turn, there's a new asynchronous programming model, right? And but if you were to put them all in, it would be complete mayhem.
Yeah.
So what are we supposed to do? You know, I think to me a few things are becoming clear about concurrency. It's like concurrency is very hard to retrofit on non-concurrent systems. That's one of the things that we're finding that you know, and concurrency also, I think, there's no free lunch with concurrency. You have to constrain the problem space in order for it to be more conducive to concurrency. You know, this notion that there will just be a slash parallelized switch or parallelized open curly bunch of code and now poof, magically it runs on however many processors there are, you know. Sorry, that's not going to happen. Especially not with code written in the imperative style that most people write it in.
Yeah.
So something's going to have to give, and we're sort of, in a sense, wrangling with what the something is. I think we do know some of the characteristics of the solution. Like, I mean, we've talked a lot about, you know, functional programming being an interesting avenue just because it is pure and has no side effects and no hidden state, and therefore, you know, it is inherently parallelizable, but functional programming, in a sense, is sort of built up of some primitive concepts like immutability and whatever that we could certainly look at formalizing more in the language. Right now, in a sense, in C#, you have to do extra work to be immutable, and you have to guarantee it yourself. You know, the compiler can't guarantee it for you, and that might be an interesting thing to think about, and it certainly is something that we're thinking about, and that would be but a small step, but it's a meaningful step, you know. I think a lot of the stuff there are other things around, you know, isolation that is a little more fuzzy, you know, but immutability is great, except it is such a pain to program with in all cases, right? I mean, like, there are cases where it's fine, but there are also cases where it's too constraining and where, in a sense, you know that it is fine to be mutable here.
Yes, yeah.
I'm working on a graph of objects here that are isolated. I haven't revealed them to anybody. No one else knows that I have these objects, and therefore it is perfectly fine for me to mutate them, right? But at some point I hand them out, or they become visible to others, possibly, at which point I want them to be immutable, right? But if there were ways of tracking that, and, you know,
in the small scale, right? If you're constructing an object, you want to kind of set some properties.
Yeah.
Well, at that point, it's mutable, but then, you know, now you want to make it immutable.
Right. Right. And how do you do that?
Yes.
Or how do you capture that in the type system? Ideally, you know. So yeah. So there are some interesting problems there that we're grappling with.
And so do you think, you know, and I think you have talked about this before, right, that, you know, a language can only have like so much features before it kind of ages and so on.
Yeah.
So how long do you think, you know, we can, you know, continue in, you know, with kind of C# and so on before, you know, it really starts to age, or maybe that we're forced because of the kind of, you know, that the assumptions about the underlying hardware change and the world change that we can, you know, how far can we, will there be a C# 5, 6 or?
I think it's good for another 37 years. I don't know. Yeah. You know, I really don't know. I don't see, you know, I think C# has matured nicely. We definitely have more concept in the language now than we had when we started, but that is the natural history, sort of a natural evolution of any programming language. I think we're holding our own fairly nicely. I think that the things we have added have been nice and additive and not very duplicative. That's sort of the danger of adding stuff, is you add stuff that is supposed to replace other stuff, but now you end up with apps that do both, and then things get confused, right? I think we can we can go for a good while longer. But I do think it's interesting also to think about, you know, other programming models for concurrency. You know, I mean, I think functional is interesting to think about for concurrency. And we will certainly, you know, in C Sharp, take as much inspiration as we can from functional programming. Well, we already have taken lots, yeah. Right? But we can't fundamentally change the nature of the beast. C Sharp is an imperative, yes, programming, yeah, language. And I still think that in today's programming, that is probably, if you had to pick just one, that's still where I would go, you know, because for the kind of apps that you know, the vast majority of people write, I mean, it's you know, we sort of have to face the fact too that it's not, concurrency isn't gonna, not everything is gonna be concurrent.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I think that the danger here is to think that everything now must be concurrent. Oh, we must have threads everywhere, or else, yeah, yeah, we're not cool, or whatever. Yeah. Well, no, honestly, I think, you know, concurrency in some ways is more of an exception than a rule. You know, I do speculate about what does my grandmother do with 64 cores on her desktop. You know, I mean, she can't read her email that fast anyhow, right? So, you know, and so today we, you know, even with a single CPU, it spends 99.999% of its time blinking the cursor, right? You know, 64 of them, yeah, well, it's in spurts, yeah, we're going to be able to use them for data parallel, you know, like compute intensive things like ideally pattern recognition, facial recognition, those sorts of things. Certainly. You know, I mean, hopefully they're but those are very specialized, and not every app needs that kind of concurrency. So I think in many ways the way concurrency will surface to the to sort of the regular programmer is really through an API, you know, that hides the concurrency inside it, right, and is massively parallel inside. But the kinds of APIs that you need then are definitely need to be more advanced, right? I mean, in an API like that, it's not enough to just pass in data, right? Mm-hmm. You typically also want to pass in code that gets orchestrated by the API, yeah, right? And you would like to know things about the code, like, is this code free of side effects so that I can execute it on multiple threads and interleaved or whatever, right? And so that's where, you know, we can do things in the language, hopefully, to you know, solidify concepts like function purity and provide guarantees around concurrency safe code, if you will, you know. But I wouldn't expect, you know, like concurrency to just be sort of in the wild in every app, you know, all, mm-hmm, over the place. That's not really how it's going to surface, in my mind.
And then, you know, we often people, when they talk about concurrency, they think about the many core situation, but there's also kind of a different kind of concurrency now with like the cloud and so on, where, you know, the computation is like much more large scale. So right. That's a very different beast, where it's not kind of close by, you're not doing data parallelism, but, you know, right, it's more coordination.
Right.
Across.
Yeah, that one is
services.
More sort of like the async concurrency.
Yes.
Or distributed, yes, and async have a lot in common. Data parallel is sort of a different kind of beast.
Yes.
And yeah. But interestingly, if you try to boil it down to sort of the essential building blocks that have to be present, there's still a lot there, you know, that is even in an async world, you know, like immutability is still meaningful when you have to remote data,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
it brings about some guarantees that you otherwise wouldn't have had, and so you know, on lambdas and remotability of lambdas, and it's like there's still stuff that, you know, benefits all of the different concurrent programming models.
Yes, and there probably you're forced to kind of have, like, you know, immutability, because if you're kind of, you know, sending stuff across the network, you know,
right,
it's really hard to,
right,
mutate, you know. But and so do you kind of, you know, like for the kind of data parallelism, I can imagine that you can do a more library approach, but, you know, and again, I mean, I want to kind of get back to the asynchronous programming,
yeah,
problem,
yeah,
and because in some sense, I often feel that, like, the current languages are very much kind of optimized, and they work great for, you know, programming in the small, where, you know, you do semicolon, mm-hmm. you know, you can compose, you know, these statements in a synchronous way. But, you know, do we need anything special to kind of compose things like at a higher scale, like asynchronously, to coordinate? How do we deal with, you know, there's like, I'm doing three web service calls, and, you know, if two of them come in, and or if it times out, you know, like, I feel that, that languages and that libraries might not work, you know, that well at that level. And people have been doing, like, yeah. you know, coordination languages in the research community.
Well, I mean, there, it certainly would be nice if our programming languages were not as synchronous as they are. They sort of imply synchronicity in core common constructs like method calls and, yes, and, yeah. and whatever, and they operate on a CPU stack, and you can't just like stop in the middle and suspend this unit of work for 3 days until the email yes, yeah. approval arrives and then rehydrate it and run again, yep. you know, and so coroutines or something like that, you know, sure, that would be nice. And I mean, there are a bunch of things there that we continue to think about. It's some of it is of a language nature, some of it is of a runtime nature. Yeah. I think that, you know, the danger is to, I think the challenge here is to find the right level of abstraction to put these things in. Like we could introduce notions of coroutines in C# and have the compiler do rewrites like it does iterator rewrites yeah. and hoist all locals into the stack and then whatever, and give you, you know, sort of different characteristics of your code and different abilities to persist running code and rehydrate it. But it's also like these massive rewrites that we would have to do such that the IL that actually executes has very little in common with yes. what you wrote, and debuggers now become very complicated, and at one point it is probably better to explore having a different VM implementation, you know, a different implementation of storage in the VM. Do you know what I mean? I know that we're talking like big hairy ideas here, yes. you know,
but we talked about that before with Joe. Yeah.
It's just dangerous to put stuff into the language that maybe is better put into the execution infrastructure.
Yeah. So in some sense, like if you look at Windows workflow, I mean, that's in like yeah. an execution environment sure. that offers a lot of these services where right. you can persist program right. running programs right. and right. you know that can coordinate. So
yep, and you know, I mean, one of the ways, I mean, this is a bit of a stretch here, maybe, you know, but one of the things that we're exploring or actually working on for C#5.0 is this uh-huh. idea of compiler as a service, where uh-huh. where you can take pieces of C# code and ask the compiler to compile them and give them back to you in a form that you can reason about, like expression trees or put it in an assembly or whatever, but where you can use the compiler as an API. Cool. And then you can then further manipulate the result of this compiled expression so you can orchestrate it yourself or rewrite it and whatever. And so we are, you know, gradually moving towards a world where the compiler isn't just this black box that, you know, you source files in and assemblies on disk.dll out, you know. Rather, it's a service that can organically be incorporated in your app, and whole new scenarios open up in the metaprogramming space and in a sort of more interactive prompt dynamic programming experience, you know, hosting inside other applications and whatever, and workflow there.
Yes, exactly. You know, so that would enable a lot of right. these things. So there also, there's an interesting twist there as well, because right now, in some sense, the expression trees in Link, or, you know, they are really not tied to Link, but the expression trees in C#, give you some of that, right? But from within the language.
Right.
Do you envision that will also be like, you know, like grown to kind of that you from within the language, I can say, give me the representation of a class or, you know, of statements?
Sure. So right now in .NET 3.5, expression trees cover only expressions.
Yes.
In .NET 4.0, they will also be able to represent statements. We will not have language support for writing, you know, bodies of code and have them be expression trees, but you can new up expression trees that represent statements and so on, and that's the infrastructure that the dynamic language runtime is built on top of. Going further out, you can imagine growing that up to also supporting full representation of classes or even assemblies, mm-hmm. for that matter, and really you could think of it as an object model for code.
Yes, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. that is at a much higher level than IL and metadata is today. How far we're going to get and when, I'm not going to be able to promise anything here, you know, but these are certainly some of our aspirations, you know, that it would be nice to.
And so how far do you know, we can take this probably really far, right? Because like the programming, the IDE should also kind of, you know, instead
sure.
of writing snippets with XML and text, you know, it would be great if I could write, you know, snippets or write my own refactorings that take
Absolutely.
These expression trees.
Oh yeah, no, and as part of compiler as a service, clearly, you know, what we're aiming to do there too is open up the services provided by the compiler in the IDE such that you can use the compiler to the output of the compiler to write your own refactorings and whatever and have the compiler provide an object model for you know the syntactic tree of your code mm-hmm. and the semantic boundary of your code. Yep, those are definitely things that we're targeting.
Okay, yeah, because that would be so cool. And so
yeah.
often, you know, it's like, you know, if you, it's like, if only I could write this refactoring, and
yeah.
and often they're like domain specific, so you cannot expect
right.
that, you know, they
no,
can
no,
write
I think
a standard in Visual Studio.
Yeah. No, it's hugely useful for our user base to be able to write their own refactorings. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to be for the faint of heart, I don't think, but some refactorings
yeah.
actually are probably not going to be all that hard to do, you know, and so, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so another question, if we're like thinking about the future and linking that to the past, like in C# 4, did you do any kind of, you know, new things in the link space? Are there like any new standard sequence operators are you thinking of other things like, you know, P-Link or things like that where
yeah.
we're using link, you know,
right.
in other dimensions than we've seen before?
Yeah, in the core of link itself, there's actually not a whole lot of new. So expression trees have grown up
yeah.
sort of to be statement trees. There are some new sequence operators like zip and whatever that,
mm-hmm.
that were missing, you know, before. But in terms of new implementations of the link concepts or link providers, if you will, we're seeing lots. And P-Link is one great example, you know, of a parallelized
yeah.
In-memory query processor. But we're sort of letting it bake for this release. We ran awful fast, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I think, you know, everybody's just still absorbing, so I think it is just fine to not, you know, go crazy with that yet. No, and I mean honestly, I think
yeah.
we covered really the majority of the ground there, you know. So yeah.
Good.
Interesting. I mean, one of the things that I noticed the Niners have been asking usually every time we have these conversations around concurrency and stuff was the notion of a language that supports DSLs,
mm-hmm.
embedded DSLs,
mm-hmm.
such that you could have like the standard small footprint kind of C# where you're expecting things, and
yeah.
they actually it happens as you expect. And then it also will host DSLs that deal with specific things like concurrency.
Right.
I mean, it could be like a functional type of syntax directly that you just write inside of your C# program.
Right.
Anyway, is there any thinking about like the way I'm not, you know, way out in the future, like C# being sort of a hosting environment
yeah.
for DSLs?
Yeah. So I think that the thing that we're initially going to enable is embedding C# in other languages, in a sense. So take a workflow-like language or a rules-based language or right where let's just say the outer syntax is XML, but then you have snippets of code or rules or whatever expressions that you, hey, why invent your own expression language? Why couldn't this just be C-sharp that I then feed to the compiler as a service, and I get back expression trees that I then, you know, manipulate or translate or
everywhere.
Or just get code. Yeah,
yeah, it's not only workflows,
right.
Like, you know, MS Build.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
Everywhere.
It's all over
at
the
some
place.
Point,
it's all
you,
over the
it
place.
Goes
yeah.
back down to strings
yeah.
that...
Yeah. And, that, yeah, and that we will enable. But then there's also this notion that you use C-sharp as the outermost DSL host, if mm-hmm. you will, and you get capabilities of metaprogramming in C-sharp itself. And that lies further out, and it's less clear how
sure.
how we get there. You know, I mean, one way of getting, you know, those kinds of capabilities is to introduce a macro processor in the language. But macros tend to not be hygienic and not type-checked and whatever, and mm-hmm. and so while they give you a lot of power, they also come with a lot of baggage, so it might not be the right way to go. Other things you could envision is, you know, running user code at compile time that either A, manipulates an AST, you know, to generate new code.
Okay.
Right, where it injects new trees into the compiler that the compiler then compiles, but then you end up with like, well, okay, but how do you debug stuff like that? Where's the
or
source for all this?
Your
yes,
code.
Yes, yes. So other ways is like user activated code that gets activated at compile time that then generates more source that you combine with partial classes or whatever, and that actually seems like that might be more doable, but you know, getting all of that mechanism in place is takes some thinking, you know.
Yeah.
And we're thinking about it. And there's certainly a lot of, I mean, there's a common theme, you know, I get asked a lot, and we have the MVP Summit just starting next week,
okay.
where a bunch of C-sharp MVPs we've invited, and already on our Reflector, you know, a bunch of people are asking about, you know, like automatic property notifications or property that send out change notifications or I want properties that know how to persist themselves, and I want properties that can do these other things. And there are all these patterns that people would like to capture somehow and automate, right?
Hmm.
And they are all sort of a macro meta-programming nature, you know, and I'd love to put in place some machinery to do that, you know, because they're, whenever there are these patterns where you're just writing the same code over
yes,
and over,
play,
it really... It's really kind of painful. And right now, you know, the best we can do is, well, why don't you go dream up your own XML DSL and then use Code DOM to write a code emitter, or like we do for DBML files in Link to SQL, or you know, but that's tough, right? I mean,
yes.
And it's not the best experience always, and it's not particularly well integrated in the IDE, and you know, maybe we could do better there, you know. So we think, but we don't have all the answers yet.
Absolutely not. And then one last thing, because we did touch on this in our last concurrency talk that we had, and I've been watching old videos on Channel 9, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been almost 5 years now, so I'm starting to reminisce about like, wow, what? They're
getting gray.
I'm getting gray.
Oh, we need like the classic 8mm Channel 9,
crazy,
you know,
man.
Without sound. Yeah,
well, I had more hair. It was black. But I think the interesting thing was I've watched this video with the late, great Jim Gray,
mm-hmm.
and... part of what we're talking about, he was like, sort of, he was convinced that the machine can do everything. So the virtual machine, the programming language really isn't that important. And I'll point people to the video where he says this. But he thinks that more could be done at the machine level, virtual machine, as you mentioned, such that developers don't really need to completely change 180 degree in their conceptual framework, because we often forget about the conceptual framework. So all I'm saying is, I haven't been hearing a lot of work that's going to be going on in the CLR itself in terms of, or maybe the JIT or whatever part of the machinery we're talking about that can help out with this concurrency.
Well, I think
problem.
Anders mentioned a couple of things, right? For example, you know, when you want to kind of deal with long-running computations that
uh-huh.
you want to persist or something, that is like, you know, is an obvious thing that you want to have like in the machine. Maybe transaction support, so I think, and also in some sense, I think with these high-level languages, the the boundary between the machine and the language is kind of, you know, not that clear, right? Because, you know, like a lot of iterators, you know, you can do it here or there. So
and the boundary to frameworks. I mean, look at something like P-Link, right? I mean, hey, I write it exactly the same way, but it runs concurrently.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't do it by introducing new IL instructions, but I actually think that's a good thing.
True.
we're at a higher level, right? I mean, and so I think in a way, a lot of the stuff that we used to do at the CLR level is sort of becoming up level to API level, you know, and that's good. That's all good.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think now we're kind of have a nice kind of, you know, we're kind of back in a circle because we started with this with a massive confusion because
now we're confused.
That's why I'm here. Yeah, there we are. Use the conversation. Yes, that's my goal.
Okay.
So we're back in the circle.
Yes, we're back in the circle where, you know, it's like unclear because, you know, like what Anders is saying, you know, people have been trying to do things with that, like with promises or futures where,
absolutely,
you know, and it's
async pattern and yeah.
And so
just throw it away and everybody should just write Haskell.
No, because Haskell is not the answer.
I had to throw that in there because this is something that we've been talking about. I mean, you add a lot of conceptual, you add a lot of functional things to imperative programming language, but the people who are using that don't understand the concepts, right? You're abstracting the functional concepts away from the imperative programmer when you do that. And so what I was just saying is that some people have been asking,
what's he talking about?
Exactly. What planet is he on?
But
this is based on the last conversation we had on Channel 9 about concurrency. We had this long discussion on a thread about somebody just saying, just use Haskell, man. And then people, you know, sort of debating at that level, which is...
Yeah, and I've said this many times, and I really think that the difference between object-oriented programming and functional programming is not that big. There's more commonality than differences.
Sure.
If you look at, like, you know, an object, it's like something that has several methods that you pass around. That's like a higher-order function. A delegate is just an object that has, like, only one method. So in that sense, it's all higher order. You're passing around pieces of code. And an object kind of encapsulates states such that, you know, these different methods can all share them. I think a big difference is whether, you know, and we talked about that, is like whether side effects, you know, how you deal with
them. That is the big
one. And that's the big difference.
I think two things. First class functions and side effects, right?
Yes.
I mean, those are sort of the two biggies.
Yes, but I would argue that first class functions is very object oriented because
that's just like passing
an interface
absolutely.
Or a class.
Yeah.
And
that one
is
about easier to do than side effect free.
Yes. And side effects, and again, side effects are good. Right, because you need side effects. It's just how do you control the side effects? Mm-hmm. So where, you know, and I think Anders agrees with that.
Put your monad on.
Not at all. It's just I'm just kind of, you know, echoing Anders that you know you have to be able to reason about effects such that you know that things are isolated and so on.
Yes.
And that's where we have to get the grip on that. But I don't think that has much to do with functional programming or object-oriented programming. It's just like, you know, it's just like, you know, that we know that this method takes a string or an int. You might want to know that it has side effects or no side effects.
Yeah. Hmm.
It's a property of your code.
Hmm.
That's at least the way I.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think, you know, but I think the things that make functional programming feel different are, you know, the first class function immutable and then the pattern matching. You know, those, you take those three together and a program starts to look very different. You know, and I think that's sort of what catches people unaware, you know, that wow, this I don't even know where to begin, you know, because these are just unfamiliar ways of doing in many ways the same thing, right?
I mean,
algebraic data types and pattern matching are really just sort of another form of polymorphism.
Exactly.
And
I prefer inheritance and virtual dispatch. The problem.
I don't know. I think you sold out since you become a big shot, man.
No. But the problem with pattern matching is that you're exposing the kind of implementation, the inner details of the objects, and so it goes against all the things of abstraction.
But when it's a closed-ended universe, when you know that there's only going to be this set of variants, then it's actually very convenient, right?
Yes.
Because it allows you to do new polymorphic constructs over that set of variants without having to, you know, sort of like go introduce a new method that now has to be implemented everywhere, and then you know. So anyway.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. But I think also a lot of times I think, like, if we would have like multi methods, right, where you could dispatch on the types of not only the this parameter, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of cases where people want to do pattern matching would disappear.
Yeah.
And yes, there's the expression problems, like, you know, in which dimension it's extensible. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's like you pick your poison, right? You either extend this direction or that direction. So yeah, maybe I'm not that much of a functional programmer.
you're quite the chameleon there.
Absolutely, man. I read his
look at that shirt there.
Exactly. Wait a minute.
I'm everything to everybody.
Yeah. Really. So the notion of creating a new language to deal with the future.
Yeah.
I mean, C sharp is not going anywhere. But what about? I mean, why not just create a new language? Right? You can still use C sharp, but create a new language.
The opportunity cost is huge for creating new, and it's getting bigger every day, because if you think about, like, look at the history of programming in a sense. Mm-hmm. It's, if you go back 25, 30 years or whatever, when I got started here in like 64K machines, right? And it took you a couple of months and you filled up all the available memory, right? And learn a new language, there was only so much you could do with it, you know, I mean, because everything was just so constrained by the physical, mm-hmm. you know, limitations of the machine. They've, by and large, now gone away. I mean, we just have this infinite memory space, practically, in 64-bit machines, right? And, like, there's just no limit to how much code you can write. And so applications have just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it takes longer and longer. Each generation drags out more and more, right? Because the cost of re-engineering all of that in a new language or on a new platform or whatever is just ever increasing, right? And so I'm not saying that there won't be new languages. Absolutely, there will be new languages. I'm just observing that they are more expensive to create, and that really, if you can leverage something that is there already, then the payoff, conversely, is so much bigger these days, right? Because because there's so much code there that people want to move forward, as opposed to just dump and rewrite, you know.
And you know, I mean, Charles, I'm completely here with Anders, because another thing is like the difference between a language and the libraries and the IDE, it's also, you know, it's not just the language, right? You cannot just write a command line compiler. No, you have to have an IDE with IntelliSense and refactoring and a debugger.
Yeah.
So that also
and
adds to the
framework,
cost.
You know,
a big framework.
Yeah.
So it just starts
like from scratch. But you could have a different machine. You could have a different virtual machine. You could start from scratch. But you could do it asynchronously.
Yeah. No.
Keep on with .NET,
hey,
but asynchronously
I'm
create
just
something
saying,
else.
You know, yeah. All I'm saying is just that the grass has to be an awful lot greener over there, and there has to be a one heck of a giant carrot, you know, before it's worth it, right? That's all. And
agreed. I mean, I think one of the carrots would be, and this is the part of the show where we go from expert to sort of ignoramus to expert. but I guess the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, Lynn Hill made a great point in an interview I did with her. She runs a parallel platform. Computing platform game, about the possibilities of a 1,000-core or a 1,000,000-core machine are so out there as far as what people can do, that we have to give them tools to be able to exploit, like, what we don't even understand what they could possibly do yet. And so all I'm saying is maybe asynchronously, starting from scratch with a new language, new tool set, new compilers, new machines, asynchronously to what we already have, maybe you guys discover something amazing and then you build a bridge.
Well, I think, you know, but I actually think that a lot of it is more if you could build new connective programming models between, you know, just islands of existing apps or imperative or whatever. You know, in many ways, I'm sort of coming to see concurrency as a choice of programming models with certain constraints in place for each of these programming models, right? Like the actor... model for concurrency where you're purely sending messages and there's no shared state or whatever. And then, like, if you're willing to buy off on these constraints in that app model, you get the following desirable qualities. But they may not always be desirable for every app out there. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's what's so sort of tricky about this problem, is that there is no one silver bullet here that just is going to take care of it, or no one single language that would just fix this problem.
Sure.
It's not like that, you know.
Yep,
and even if you have like a million machines, I think they're all like, you know, little imperative things that you glue together in
sure.
some way
yeah.
where you have to kind of contain
yeah.
these imperative effects to,
yeah.
each unit. Mm-hmm. So I think
excellent.
In some sense we're not that far off, I think. The future will look much more closer to the past than you think, Charles.
Oh, if history is any guide, yeah.
Yes.
Excellent. Back to the future.
I mean, look at the programming languages used today. Not that different from
Fortran.
From Fortran or Lisp. They're
yes,
50 years old, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah.
Excellent, you guys. Well, this has been amazing.
Well, thank you.
We can just keep on going, but I might run out of hard drive. And Anders probably has work to do. I know you do.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Anders.
No,
this was great. Yeah.
Yeah. No,
and I think great. The viewers will enjoy it as well, I'm pretty sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.